Hello, everybody, and welcome to the March 2022 edition of Poet Radio here on WGXC. My name is Chris. I'm the host of the monthly program. And this month, I'm recording the session at Bard College. I'm with Professor Cole Heinowitz, who was formerly a guest on this show with her band, Satan's Black Acid, William Staples and Cole Heinowitz. And this time we're going to just have Cole here as a writer and translator, poet. I'm very happy to have Cole on the program this month. She is originally from California, is that correct?
Yeah.
Yes, and ever since I saw Cole perform with Satan's Black Acid maybe 3 or 4 years ago, we've been in dialogue, we've collaborated on musical projects and become good friends. Cole's back on the program. We'll be talking about her translations, her poetry, and who knows what else. Welcome, Cole.
Thank you,
Chris. Is there anything else I should have said there?
No, that seems pretty comprehensive.
All right. So where would you like to start? I know you've picked out some things to read. Why don't we jump right in?
Yeah, well, I thought that I would read a poem of my own first, and that would be the kind of bass tone, since you were asking earlier about the process that leads me to translate one thing and then another. It seems like actually the process I go through in writing poems is the first step to the translating. So I thought I'd read one of those poems and then maybe kind of go in chronological order to tell the story of how translating Mario Santiago turned into translating Artaud and Pizarnik.
That sounds great. Excellent.
So I'm going to just start with a poem of my own. It's dedicated to Peter Seaton, an extraordinary poet who passed away 12 years ago. It's called Understanding Heraldry. Yes, they are alive and can have those colors. When you see a picture of Peter, you think about Peter, who's thinking he can talk to the dead. The idea was not original. From ancient times, warriors and rulers adopted tribal symbols that in time came to represent faces, which came to mean faces by incorporating features of the faces of the vanquished dead. There are endpoints to any spectrum, leading questions, deixis. Does it seem dead? Are you quite dead? The set dictates you be very dead with me now, even if I cannot ever stop remembering you, even if you really are Peter, the ox, the owl, and the eagle are familiar to everyone. All of them turn on the same structural problem. The outside is bigger, but strangely no more visible than the inside. Our pictures, close as they may be to you, lack a certain feature difficult to specify, whose absence gives symbolic status to the object. It was during endless winters that moments undoubtedly arose, and blazonry from an origin equally yet to come and already happened. We talk, but we cannot revive them, the mound of fading objects called environment. It is not an environment. It is a concept. But now you say we're coming to an end. The model has nothing to do with precision. Everything a casual instance of wishing you were here, and you are. For you are pondering escape. The six lions rampant, or three, then two, then one. Passant, guardant, in order of descent, similar to types found in the vicinity of Nantes. Yes, they are alive and can have those colors by hereditary right, a meaningless stain when looked at straight on, only acquiring contours of a face in retrospect, in the whole wild life of comparing you to an alien species. They walk off, become themselves only in retrospect. A new image of the thinker. He carries the apple spray, the emblem of victory. A picture of Peter who isn't there, only the compassionate landscape itself. The jilted dead are a part of it, When I see a picture of Peter, I think of Peter thrown into ecstasy because he isn't there. A chevron between three swans argent, one whereof we still retain the crest. Having captured life like a fish on a hook, the reactive forces turn against themselves with the subtle coordination of actors with nothing to act. Hear the words expire, become ours. In their protest against women, they walk off, become themselves as if to die with, to desire. And all that babble about the decline of paternal authority conceals how swell the ride was to hear. Where by sight, the nobles climbed in to fight against the absence of the vocabulary of the thing written. And coming and leaving, in short, the whole life of you preparing the ground for defense. Draw, they said, so we can make sure we're here. Through this room, they took me to my father. White hot, those colors where the border figured a second ago, a heavyset, heavenly radiance, white rose within a sun, within a treasure, two bodies conjoined to one head, an overall paralysis. We laugh about that tonight, and suddenly, forever after. What we're saying is we don't have to worry about their not being there. Mind, where the picture appears heading up to a lack, is local, the enclosure itself. Or rather, the feeling of loyalty to the group, the marks written in the community of them. We are somehow trained by smiles, the shape of a face, to assume this commitment to a secret we will never know but cannot doubt any more than that blood is, in the mystical names of the rulers, another way of saying embodiment. I had a feeling, Peter said, seemed to be a continuation of my arms, that possibility being utterance, as either he or she or anyone once made a rose jewels cross the scallops of the third, the old surmise in both, you should have been with us. The lights off slowly surround you and in time represent what you're asking. Is this something internal to Peter or to the concept of Peter? In the purest sense, this is not a question, but the kind of forgetting we hear has been around forever, in fact, written into the blackness as the second death we use to make the first one appear right. Yes, they are alive and can have those colors, but what we're really aiming at is something else, something you have to keep your eyes open for. I mean, the refusal of those colors that spread from one melody to every canvas, inexorably leaving you in the sand, breathing air, regarding the primitive foundation of a planet in terms of what you mean to me. This is the art of the allegorical way of saying hello, of fighting for insertion into someone else's life no longer. It is no longer twilight, but it's so dark in here, not swinging freely, not dead, but dying to be touched. In a way, it is the point from which the picture looks back at us.
Is that a poem written at the time of Peter's passing?
Yeah.
But it's not your ordinary elegy in that it encompasses all this other material, other sort of conceptual ideas, and the allegory of saying hello. In an elegy, that's interesting. Embracing the entrance into another sphere, right?
Yeah. I was thinking about forms of commemoration and representing the absent as present. And so strangely found myself drawn into books of heraldry and, of course, wading through a lot of the patriarchal layers of heraldic representation. But what it ended up giving into was a feeling of really being with Peter that I hadn't anticipated. And I think partly it was because I was drawing from a word bank that was almost entirely foreign to me. And it was just that much displacement from the words as they come out of my own brain that allowed space for him to emerge.
The word bank being the book on heraldry.
Yeah. Right? The reason I wanted to start by reading that poem is because it's part of a project I'm still working on, but also it feels the most congenial to the work I do as a translator. And this practice of moving myself aside in order to make room in a language that is foreign for another presence to come through.
When I hear things like that, I think of the practice of outside, right? And how that is such a great ideal for poets, yet difficult, I'd say, for most people to break through that self, even when looking at somebody or something else or trying to.
Yeah. Even sitting, talking, having a conversation. Mm-hmm. It is hard to listen. I think we're more qualified to speak than to listen. So I try to push my speaking as far towards listening as it can go. But yeah, I mean, we were talking about Keats earlier and our shared young attraction towards the romantics. And for me, a touchstone of this, even before Spicer and the Spooks and the practice of outside, I think of that Keats letter to John Hamilton Reynolds, where he says, "Even now I may be speaking from some other soul, not my own."
Mm-hmm.
One's a special one because it identified for me when I was very young a state that growing up and still to this day I find largely unpleasant, but it's an inherent facet of my being, which is being porous and chameleonic in the sense not of willful shape-shifting, but of sort of seamless adapting to what one is around.
Mm-hmm.
And Keats says, you know, it doesn't matter. I could be in a room full of children. I could be in a room full of parliamentarians. I can't go home to myself after being immersed in the words and the world of others.
No wonder we like him.
Yeah.
Right?
I also think we're still in the romantic period. And I think that the writers I translate are romantic writers. I don't much see a difference between what we call postmodern and what we call romantic.
Hmm.
I mean, the fascination with the end of empires, like you see in a poem like Ozymandias, or like Oliver Goldsmith's The Deserted Village, these are death knells sounding for cultures that, yes, are past, but with which contemporary writers identified deeply.
Right. So you're talking about how this poem is a good way to bring in, you know, to talk about, you know, your work as a translator, right?
Yeah. So I wanted to read a piece of the first book that I translated.
Great.
And that book is called Advice from a Disciple of Marx to a Heidegger Fanatic. And it's by Mario Santiago Papasquiaro. It was written now about 50 years ago, and it's his earliest long poem. I wouldn't read the whole thing, but this is a Mexican poet who was really influenced by the Beats, and particularly the strain in the Beats that goes back to the Transcendentalists and the Romantics. So can I read a little bit of his first long poem?
Absolutely.
Okay. The world gives you itself in fragments, in splinters. In a melancholy face, you glimpse a brushstroke by Dürer. In someone happy, the grimace of an amateur clown. In a tree, the trembling of birds sucking from its crook. In a flaming summer, you catch bits of the universe licking its face. The moment an indescribable girl rips her Oaxacan blouse just at the crescent of sweat from her armpits. And beyond the rind is the pulp, and like a strange gift of the eye, the lash. Maybe not even carbon-14 will be able to reconstruct the true facts. The days are gone when a naturalist painter could ruminate over the excesses of lunch between movements of Swedish gymnastics, and without losing sight of the rose-blue tones of flowers he wouldn't have imagined even in his sweetest nightmares. We are actors of infinite acts, and not exactly under the blue tongue of movie spotlights. For example, now that you see how Antonioni passes by with his usual little camera, observed by those who prefer to bury their heads in the grass to get drunk on smog or whatever so as not to add to the scandals that already make the public roads impassable by those who were born to be lavishly kissed by the sun and its earthly ambassadors, by those who talk of fabulous copulations, of females you can't believe in this geological age, of vibrations that would make you a fervent propagandist for Zen Buddhism, by those who at one point were saved from the accidents the crime rags call substantial, and that, by the way, for now, aren't counted among the flowers of the absurd. That's how it is on the trapeze, on the tightrope of this thousand-ring circus. An old man rattles on about the thrill he felt at seeing Gagarin fluttering like a fly in outer space, and pity the starship wasn't called Icarus One, that Russia is so fiercely anti-Trotskyite. And then his voice dissolves, collapses, between cheers and boos. Reality and desire get thrashed, get chopped up. They spill out over each other like they never would in one of Cernuda's poems. Foam runs from the mouth of the one who speaks wonders, and it would seem he lived in the clouds and not on the outskirts of this barrio. The humid air of April, the lewd wind of autumn, the hail of August and July, all here present with their fingerprints. Alcohol, piss, what hasn't fertilized this grass? How many sub-minimum wage gardeners will leave their watery proteins in this trap? For now, you stretch out face down toward the shade of the long and hairy legs of the park where they gather. The one who dreams of revolutions that stay too long in the Caribbean. The one who'd like to rip out the eyes of the billboard heroes to expose the hollowness of the farce. The girl with the feline and filmic green eyes, even if on getting closer they turn out to be blue or who knows. The student all adrenaline and erupting pores, the one who believes in nobody, nor in the Kantian beauty of some admirers of Marcuse, and bursts out yelling that we're putrefied by rage, dehydrated from so many tomes of theory, the occasional little whore who shares the torrent of her solitude with strangers, letting grace, sympathy, sudden vibrations tip the scale of supply and demand, chance. That other anti-poet and incorruptible bum, those who come here to weep until they carve for themselves, as in wood, the face of some paranoid martyr after smashing, not exactly from devotion, the seats of the movie theaters, the one who writes his will or his epitaph on a wrinkled napkin and then blows kisses to the wind, and everyone assumes it's his birthday or last night he got hitched in holy matrimony, and all the hypotheses turn out too fragile to explain why he used a gun and not a can of paint if he seemed capable of seducing to the point of fever, the pulse, and the pupil of Giotto, the one who always greets you with, I'm desperate, and yourself? Those who love rabidly like street dogs through thick and thin, and one calls them blooming lovers, and they're aphrodisiacs not only to the sensibilities of Marc Chagall, those who meet death in person in the hour when suicide becomes an obsession, a disheveled desire to bite and be bitten, to have done with all those pipe dreams that seem indestructible, to momentarily create such a power that the daily cement mixers destroy you like one brown paper bag, and then you understand the one who like to bury under mountains of plants, buildings, black earth, the slightest beat, the tachycardia of his intimate history. You're infected with the nervousness, the anxiety of those who act like they breathe, like they have some trace of carnivorous plants about them, and spend hours waiting for their companion tenderness, that call girl who rarely arrives. Those who come running from the tear gases and billy clubs of the major avenues, of the major and minor stains that can't be removed with Pine-Sol or the stroke of a Kleenex. Those who ignore who they are and don't even want to know, when the climate's reputation gets worse by the day, those perpetual sufferers from amnesia who suck their thumbs with joy because the earthly paradise is here and not in Miami, those who promise to declare this autonomous territory, independent island that will not degrade into scrap metal ruins supermarkets. At the moment a hit song entangles its rhythm with the rain's strange samba, and a fatally fleeting order is established so they can continue to dominate the scene, hair in disorder, enormous eyes moist, and, as if risen from the very chiaroscuro of the night, a girl appears, her muddy fists against her thighs, repeating 1, 2, 3 times, I am not a sex object. I am not that, you robots. I'm alive, like a forest of eucalyptus. Here, where the norm is to be implacably nice to each other. And this is the lesser evil. The park trembles. My inner steps carry me through the streets of a green seaport the natives call mescaline. A sensation unknown until now. Like being scientifically certain what DNA tastes like after making love. If this isn't art, I'll slash my vocal cords, my tenderest testicle. I'll stop blathering if this isn't art. A tree branch bends under the weight of a sparrow, or rather, a sparrow ends up shattering a branch that's already broken. We're still alive. Somehow or other, we must name the islands of crystals that with the luxury of violence trample the softest regions of your eyes. Reality seems like a miniature made to scale from mica, but also your eyelids, your perception, and its straitjacket. Matter and energy and the courage to stick your tongue inside their tongue. This is a very peculiar day. Vibrant, quotidian, anonymous, absolutely earthly, as we often say on days of celebration or during the ever more frequent house raids, the fear lights up your stomach and it burns. There is no ahistorical anguish. To live here is to hold your breath and undress. I'll stop there.
You're going to have to say the name of the poet again, just because I didn't quite get that.
His name is Mario Santiago Papasquiaro.
This is not a well-known poet, unfortunately.
The way most people know who he is, if they know who he is because he was fictionalized in Roberto Bolaño's The Savage Detectives as Ulysses Lima. And so, strangely enough, the way I ended up translating him to begin with was because a bunch of students who were big Bolaño fans but didn't read Spanish said, hey, we heard about this Ulysses Lima guy. We want you to do a tutorial on Ulysses Lima and what he really wrote, because I heard he really was a poet. So that's how it all started.
The poems are, they're so, poem, the section of the poem you read is so active and vibrant. I imagine maybe more well-known in Mexico.
Very well-known and very maligned.
Is that right?
Yeah, he did not play the game well. He would like bust in on Nobel laureate speeches and steal the mic. He, you know, break cocktail glasses over famous poets' heads.
Yikes. All right. Well, yeah, I guess didn't fit in with the establishment.
No, right, and they really, it was much more of an institutional, top-down literary culture. Mm-hmm. In Mexico in the 70s, 80s, and 90s than here.
So the poem, that poem is from the 70s?
Yeah, 75, 76.
One thing I could get from it was you mentioned it was like influenced by beat, and there was a certain point at which, you know, that sounded beat. And also a little bit surrealist.
Definitely.
Too, you know, not just straightforward, but...
So that's where the seed of Artaud was planted for me and Pizarnik, because they're the two very big figures from Santiago Papasquiaro.
How's that?
He has a beautiful poem that he wrote to Pizarnik that got me wanting to read more of her. And there was a fairly pronounced identification that he had and Pizarnik had with Artaud as well.
Papasquiaro?
Yeah.
Was first that came to your
that memory? Was the first, that was when I started to translate seriously.
Excellent. And you have, and besides, I mean, I'm hoping we'll have time certainly to hear some of the other translations, but you've done Pizarnik and Artaud, and Papaschiaro. What are the other translations that I don't know about?
There's a contemporary Mexican poet named Javier Taboada, who I'm translating his most recent book right now. It's called El Niño de Varas, which I'm translating as Stick Boy. And I've translated some other younger Mexican poets like Felipe Fabre.
So you're bilingual with Spanish, but you must also, if you translate Artaud, that would be French, right?
Yeah.
Right, so that's exciting.
Would you like me to read some Pizarnik?
I would definitely like for you to read some. I mean, if now's a good time, if that tracks well with your other, in line with the other things you've been reading, sure. I want to remind listeners that this is Poet Radio on WGXC. My guest today and this month is Cole Heinowitz, a poet and translator. Wanted to remind people that although our 2022 spring pledge drive may be complete, WGXC, I don't know if you heard this, Cole, and I don't know if you've ever actually been out to a wave farm, but they just installed solar panels, so now WGXC
Wow, fantastic.
Yeah, we're sustainable in more ways than one, and we're always looking for sustaining members. A monthly donation helps the station go a long way. So keep all that in mind, wgxc.org/donate. Let's get back to the poetry and translation with Cole Heinowitz.
The book that came out most recently of translations of Pizarnik is actually a book of her essays. And I wanted to translate that not only because it was untranslated, but because, like all of the poets I find myself drawn to or drawn into company with, there's a sustained capacity for listening to other poets and listening into other poets as a way of coming to one's own poetry. And there were a number of essays that aren't exactly generically stable. They sometimes are characterized as prose poems, sometimes as fiction, sometimes as essays. And I ended up not being able to include some of them in the book precisely because they fall through these category cracks. Mm-hmm. And the estate has to maintain those generic categories or chooses to retain them for translators. So I wanted to have a chance to share something that didn't make it into the covers of the book, which is called A Tradition of Rupture.
Right, and this is fairly recent. It's come out in the past couple of years, right? The 2019 first printing. This is a publication. It's in the Lost Literature series of Ugly Duckling Press. So the estate's not going to mind that you did the translations and you read them, but they couldn't go into the...
Correct.
The book has different sections, right? Prologue and interviews, and then it has... essays and articles, so there are some definition happening here. Let's have some unpublished translations here. Fabulous.
Okay, so this is a piece called The Dead in the Rain. There once was a man who lived by a graveyard, and no one ever asked him why. And why would anyone have needed to ask? I don't live next to a graveyard, and no one asks me why. Something lies corrupted or diseased between the yes and the no. If a man lives next to a graveyard, don't ask him why. And if he lives far away from a graveyard, don't ask him either. But this man didn't live next to a graveyard by chance. They will say that everything is random, starting with the place you live. I couldn't care less what they say, because no one tells me anything when they think they're saying something. All I hear are my hopeless murmurings, liturgical chants that rise from the sacred tomb of my illicit youth. It's a lie. Right now, I'm listening to La Teleña sing the Threepenny Opera. Of course, this refers to a record, but it never ceases to amaze me that in the lapse of 3 years between the last time I listened to it and now, nothing has changed for La Teleña, and a lot, maybe everything, if everything were known, has changed for me. I've known death, and I've known the rain. Perhaps that's the reason, that and nothing else. Only that rain falls on graves. only because of the rain and the dead, that there could have been a man who lived next to a graveyard. The dead don't send auspicious messages. Bad luck and patience, since life is a gap in the musical education of silence. But something stirs and comes out of hiding when rain falls on a graveyard. I've seen it myself, the little men in black, lost poets chanting nomads' dirges, and the ones in robes soaked by the rain and the useless tears, and my father too young with the hands and feet of a Grecian youth. My father must have been frightened his first night in this ferocious place. The people and the little men in black quickly abandoned the graveyard. One ragged man stayed by my side as if to assist me in case I needed help. Maybe he was the neighbor referred to in the story that begins, "There once was a man who lived by a graveyard." Oh, the record has changed, and La Dalena appears aged. All of the dead are drunk on a dirty, unknown rain in the foreign Jewish graveyard. Only in the patter of rain on the graves can I know something of what I'm terrified to know. Blue eyes, eyes embedded in the fresh earth of the empty trenches of the Jewish graveyard. If there were an empty cottage by the graveyard, if it could be mine, and to take possession of it like a ship, and to watch my father's grave in the rain through a telescope, because communion with the dead only happens in the rain, when the dead return and some of the living tell stories of spirits, specters, and apparitions. I tend to grow closer to my departed in winter, as if the rain made it possible. It's true that nothing matters to whomever or whatever they call God, but this passage I read in the Talmud is also true. God has three keys, one for rain, one for birth, and one for the resurrection of the dead.
So is there more of this type of, like, more prose poem work? Are you thinking about translating or doing another book of Pizarnik, or no?
I think this is probably going to be it. And I think that all of the other works have a home and and are forthcoming, or at least in the beginning openings of the pipeline, so to speak.
Right, right. So how did this piece end up in your hands if it wasn't really part of the collected writing?
Oh, yeah.
Critical writing.
Because when I was talking to Matvey at Ugly Duckling, he initially said, include whatever you would want to include in this book that hasn't, you know, already been translated. And so there's a different manuscript that didn't make it into a binding when we actually went through the process of speaking with the estate and finding out what was available to be published.
And are they doing more translations by her? I did see that it's listed somewhere. I can't remember where.
Yeah, they've done an earlier book, which was translations of the Arbol de Diana, the Diana's Tree. They've published a couple of volumes of her poems.
Right, right, yeah. It's interesting what makes its way to us and what doesn't. Like, for some reason, Pizarnik came to me like 30 years ago, but yet I don't know, you know, I don't know some of these other, you know, I don't know, it's sort of hit or miss, I guess. This is why I think it's very important that what Ugly Duckling's doing, what other presses are doing, getting more into our consciousness from the Americas.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, this is Argentinian writer, Mexican writers, and you're helping them along the way. Thank you, Cole. It's very good work. You're talking before about, you know, pressing beyond the self, and translation is that too, right? I mean, instead of like just working on your own poems, not that they wouldn't be valuable and visionary or whatever. Translation is a real service. I mean, I hope you see it that way.
I do.
Right. I mean, if you have the skill set to be able to read and write and understand, wow.
I don't know if I'll be able to put my finger on it directly, but there's something, a very, very short prose poem that Pizarnik has about what you just said. Here, I found it.
Oh, great.
Night, the poem. If you find your true voice, Bring it to the land of the dead. There's kindness in the ashes and terror in non-identity. A little girl lost in a ruined house, this fortress of my poems. I write with the blind malice of children pelting a madwoman like a crow with stones. No, I don't write. I open a breach in the dusk so the dead can send messages through.
That's the outside.
Right? Yeah.
Right. Very interesting. Cool. So what was the connection now between Pizarnik and Artaud? She was interested in Artaud.
I think for a few reasons. One, because Pizarnik was also trained as a visual artist.
And I didn't know that.
So she was interested in the crossover between writing as a process of signification and writing as mark making. And so I think she was very drawn to the notebooks that he produced. I think it was at Rodez, where it's just, he writes one letter over and over and over in a composition book, basically to keep the muscle memory of what it is to make a mark fresh. So I think she was responding to his visual poetics and also to his work in the theater, because Pizarnik also was a playwright and was interested in the possibility of harnessing multiple voices and putting them in dialogue at a spectacular level. And then, of course, though, I think as someone who lived with very severe mental illness, there was a sense of affinity and solace that she took in his frankness about dwelling on the edge of the void. But, for example, she used to put her poems up on the wall and edit them as you would a visual composition. Contemplate them using a sensibility from another discipline in order to bypass her emotional or intellectual volition in language. And so some of her experimental practices like that were taken from Artaud or modified from things that Artaud did.
It's not, although I've been a reader of her poems for many years, I wasn't quite aware of that process, that mode. It seems like that would have a very, wouldn't that have a great effect on the content of the poems? To edit them visually rather than through the language or the structure of the lines, stuff like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. I have a volume of the poems here, but they're not... I mean, who knows what the editors did with these, right? Because this is all like left justified, and it looks like poetry. But the kind of process that you're talking about would seem to be maybe make it more visual. Is that?
No, actually, the poems in their original form tend to be standard left justified. Just the same way, though, that if you pick up, you know, a Burroughs cut up novel, it looks like
prose. Regular prose.
Because it doesn't, the final product doesn't include marks of the process in a visual way.
That's true. Maybe it should. I mean, I'd like to see colors and whatnot, color coded. Like when you see someone like Cage with the color, some of the color differences, I mean, that makes makes a major impact on how you read it. So what about you and getting to Pizarnik and Artaud in particular? I mean, this is it's a beautiful book, right? This is a hardcover book with lots and lots of pictures and graphics. It's generous with visuals. And these are letters. It's a collection of letters called Succubations and Incubations, and letters from the mid-40s. So you have the ability to translate anything. You could have translated any number of artists, I'm sure. But what brought you to Artaud? Which came first?
Santiago Papasquiaro came first, and then Artaud, and then Pizarnik. The book that you have there was co-translated with the poet Peter Valente. So we came to these letters because of their ability to reveal aspects of Artaud's process that are implicit or suggested in his better known writings. And because they're late letters, they have a very large historical sweep. He's looking back to his beginnings and drawing connections. So the letters, in a way, they connect the pieces, the scattered pieces of his personal mythology, and create a cohesive narrative, perhaps too cohesive, right? It's frighteningly coherent, the vision that he puts forth. But another thing that was a motivating factor, both in the Artaud letters and the Pizarnik essays, was to make available to English language readers a lesser known side of well-known and widely admired writers, and to do a little bit in the hopes of curbing the somewhat caricatured version that often tends to emerge. Pizarnik, especially because of the earlier translations, like what was translated earlier, I think that the first thing was her writings about Elspeth Bathory, the Bloody Countess. And so the first publications that came over in English of Pizarnik were very adaptable during the culture wars to gender politics. And she therefore developed this position, a character, almost as the little girl lost, the vulnerable little girl, the wicked little girl, you know, whereas Artaud has his madman facade, you know, his St. Peter's staff and his ejection from Ireland and his copping heroin and his terrifically strained relationships with women. And both the Pizarnik essays and the Artaud late letters have a self-reflective quality that resists those kinds of very striking, dramatic, strong caractures.
In this case of the Artaud, there's just some beautiful writing and sensibility that is reflected. I notice that you have a couple of other books over there that you brought to the session. What are they?
Well, this one, Bleeding from All Five Senses, is the most recent Mario Santiago Papasquiaro book that I translated. And it's a collection of maybe 50 poems that cover the span of his career. And this one is a book that Benjamin Hollander, the late great poet, edited for Spuyten Duyvil just before his death, which was a collection he invited a bunch of poets and artists to share letters to Charles Olson. So I brought that along.
You've made the contribution to the book?
Yeah.
All right. Well, what would you like to do? I would say we have maybe 10, 15 more minutes at most. We could, I think we should end with you reading something of your own. But if you want to, if there's something from the Papasquiaro book you want to read, that's or more Pizarnik, isn't whatever you like.
Well, I feel like the one gap in terms of listeners being able to hear the language of the book we're referring to is the Artaud. So maybe would you pass it over and
yeah,
I can just
sure.
read a small
piece
from one of the letters? Okay. Yeah, I haven't had a chance to pick out my favorite, so this is going to be, as is appropriate for Chris Funkhauser's show, an aleatory process of arriving at it. Okay, so this is actually a wonderful place to dip into. This is a letter to Madame Jean Dubuffet, written at Rodez in November 29, 1945. I'll just read, it's a long letter, so I'll only read the beginning of it. I wanted to specially thank you for your very affectionate attentions to me, sending butter, sardines, and green coffee, that is, for understanding that it was the absence of fats and my state of malnutrition that caused the state of disarray where, at certain hours of the day, the consciousnesses of all my friends are swept away by a destroying wind blown by the maneuvers of obscene bewitchment by monks in the Himalayas and the populations of Burma, Bengal, Turkestan, and Afghanistan. At times, the people of Paris and other cities in France involve themselves in these hateful dissociative maneuvers, as well as, at certain hours, under the protection of the police, as I told you. This abominable state of affairs must cease, for if, as you know, I am full of hatred for Jesus Christ, I am equally full of hatred for the Antichrist, who was never more than his minion and an object of his bewitchment. I went to Mexico, to the summit of a mountain more than 5,000 meters high, to put a stop to certain Christ-like maneuvers of white magic, from which all black magic was always fomented, both directly by the spirit of contradiction and also by another spirit that never tolerated the white. I will therefore go, and I want to go right away, to Tibet to finish off this dreadful work. But to do this, I need a cane that I expressly prepared for this purpose, and whose failed prototype is the cane of St. Patrick with which I made my journey to Ireland, and which is now in the hands of that so-called Annie Besnard at 45 Quai Bourbon, who is no more than a double, since the real Annie Besnard was assassinated after October 14, 1944, the date on which she took the train from the Orléans station in Paris to come meet me here. My story is not that of the prophecy of St. Patrick, which you know, since you read it in the Dictionary of Hagiography, published in 1894, of which there was a copy in 1934, the date when I first read the prophecy, on the shelves in the public room of the National Library. My story is therefore not that of this prophecy, which, in 1894, 2 years before I was born, contained sections of verses from the Umbilicus of Limbo, published in 1925, but another story that tries by any means to escape from that of the prophecy which before my birth read my verses in my stillborn head. I want myself that the verses I write, the drawings I draw, be born from my personal inspiration, immediate and actual, and not be poked at and pinched in advance by I know not what criminal spirit of the past in my present. For this spirit is called Lucifer, it is called Jesus Christ, and it is called Christ Parabrahma, the spirit embodied one day from the abyss of the void. All this, dear madam and friend, is to remind you of something and make you understand something essential, both for myself and for you. And this is that your individual consciousness of being will be lost if I cannot definitively defend my own. My own will not sink, but I cannot defend the consciousness of my friends based on the duration and integrity of my own if my friends do not resolve to understand that it is urgent for them to bring me some assistance, not in the everyday sense, that is to say, in the sense of a poet who was committed and then granted liberty, but who does not have the financial means to live in the outside world or the circle of relations needed to care for him, but rather in a sense that is against everyday life. That is to say, like a voyager of infinite irritation toward the monstrosity of this earth, and who, just as he went to Mexico to silence the old sorcerers, wants to go to Tibet to grab those black magicians, the lamas, by the throat, and on the way to blow up St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, and even more, the Basilica of St. John Lateran. I have prepared a cane for this purpose, which is in the hands of my daughter, Catherine Chile, who you saw from afar defending me yesterday, Thursday, November 29th, all day long, and you and Jean Dubuffet have also struggled with me and have even told me as I was sitting at the table at 6 in the evening and you were both feeling asphyxiated, hollowed in the bone and in the sex, raped in the throat by the organ of evil, you spoke to me as the loving souls of friends and close relations who trust me completely and come to ask for my support. But what is the matter, Monsieur Artaud? I made 2 signs to help you, with my breath and my hand like two lilac arched racks in my body between my shoulder blades and my thorax, and I think this must have given you relief. Yourself, Jean Dubuffet, René Desolier, and Henri Parisseau.
I'm glad you pulled that out, or we pulled that out, because it reminded me of how glorious that book is. But there's certain recurring things like the cane and whatnot throughout the letters, because the letters are to all different people. And, you know, so that was, I mean, although it's kind of born out of a torturous situation, it's very playful at the same time, right? And
yes.
Especially like to the reader, you know, years and years later, right? We read this, it's almost like fiction. So anyway, thanks for reading that. That was a good aleatory choice there. So yeah, I think we should probably move towards wrapping things up.
Maybe I should read the letter to Olson, since we've moved into the domain of letters.
All right,
intimate.
That would be great. Anything else our listeners need to know about your activities or plans? How's the band doing?
Pretty good. We're working on a second 7-inch.
All right. All right. Yeah. That's.
Well, I have a viola now.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. I mean, it's funny. People do know you as a writer and a professor, but not as many know you as a musician, especially in the type of band that you play in, which is exciting music, improvisation, and loud, which we love. All right. Well, once again, you've been listening to Poet Radio with Cole Heinowitz, and here she's going to read a letter that she wrote to Charles Olson after the fact of his life.
Okay, here we go. Letter to Charles Olson. You cut into story the primary equal of its parts, of what has been converted from legend and myth into something called history, where people having lived here for millennia, unrelieved, more or less escapes the conversation. You know the diminishment I mean, the present loss of context and the misery of expenditure and gain, for which read urgency. What is it with this country that will not wait a minute before it strikes, but is always looking for its history as a transcript of experience, which doesn't have what this or that girl said or did? And this is loss. Anyone who would try to make this reappear as art has to damn well respect the consequences, to make them clear, to compose his refusal of the misery in abundance, to walk in that world where you find the real in any direction, not the spent presentation of some American event, lifting up meaning only to break it on the floor, asserting it should have been realism. Dear Charles, I'm not going to write to you from my usual position of giving reasons for not writing to assure you I'm alive, because today is good. The old voices I've neglected have come back and are demanding an outlet with surprising kindness given the criminals they've had to live with. Anyway, I dreamt last night about your vision of the beautiful boat, but either my memory failed or my eyesight did, and I realized I'd have to build the thing entirely from scratch. At first I froze. Then suddenly the boat tacked and I was jumping sideways to avoid being hit by the boom. I was reading this in a book I could see but couldn't feel. When I went to turn the page, my fingers didn't touch anything. It was the sacred book of language. It was open to a page that read, "Work dexterously with delight. Draw everything out from your heart. Meet it with your mind. Compose the pieces. Make them adjust." There was something throbbing in my heart, dark with a red glow, spreading into my guts and throat. I wanted it to spread through my limbs and radiate out of my body, but I only knew how to draw the forces in. So I gathered it back to my heart and rocked it like a baby. Someone on my left was beating the air away from my head with a feather. The shapes of an eagle and then a butterfly appeared in a fierce red glow. They drew closer and closer until all I could see was the color. Steora, star from a bird's wing. Back when human language was an animal, it carried the earth and the sky in its mouth, and everything spoke. That was when the sun fell in love with the moon. Sun had heard that moon was contained in an old hollow log, so he scooped out the log to build a boat that would carry them away. Foolish sun, swelling sun, lie quiet. Moon is missing, and only deer can bring her back. Lie quiet, sun, and wait for deer to pass, for nothing lasts. So sun waited the entire day, and when night finally came, moon appeared in the sky. Sun stole a deerskin to disguise himself and flew to her, and they were joined. Moon shone brightly then, but soon she went in search of other lovers, and the more she loved, the more brightly she shone. She grew so bright that no living thing on earth could sleep, and everyone went mad. They begged Sun to put out one of her eyes, and because Sun was jealous of Moon's lovers, he did. Dear Charles, this morning someone told me that the weathermen split from SDS and became terrorists because they were brainwashed by a cult. He remembered being at what he thought was a party when he realized that everyone was performing a ritual and that they wanted him to join. For several minutes, he felt the blackest guilt for all the beings he had harmed, willingly or not. Then, all of a sudden, the guilt disappeared, and in every cell he felt his oneness with the universe. Since I knew you studied Crowley, I thought, now is the time to write to Olsen and tell him why I've been silent so long. He will understand. This is a ritual to banish silences. Love, Cole.
Sweet. So just to for my own edification, your interest in Olsen comes from where? Or how did you get involved with this dialogue, with imaginary, become real dialogue with his work?
Gosh, I mean, it's hard to put a date to that or a chronology to that, except to say that Olsen came into my orbit very young, when I went to Naropa 30 years ago, and was sort of one of those figures that was always in the background and to whom the poets that meant most to me from the beginning, especially poets associated with the San Francisco Renaissance, were harking back. And that I just continued to be in conversation with him, and if not Olsen directly, maybe more frequently even John Wieners and Diane de Prima.
Very good, very touching, sweet. Fantastic, Cole. Well, great to be with you, and you know, onward we go, and thanks so much for
thank you, Chris,
being here and hosting a show at Bard today.